Welcome to this week's edition of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and we are here to talk about the Oscars. Even though it's a little bit, it's kind of icy and snowy outside, which I thought the Oscars were in March, so I kind of, something missed me.
So is this going to be our lowest rated show ever?
Because of what?
The Oscars,
which were the lowest rated Oscars.
Obviously nobody cares about
the
Oscars.
I didn't even know the writer's strike was over.
Well,
apparently
yeah.
It was just in time for them to write at least two jokes for the Oscars.
Well,
and those would be...
Jon Stewart did as well.
Who hosted?
No, they said he did okay, yeah.
Yeah, Jon Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he had that little section where he was playing the Wii with the girl, which apparently was very funny and just interesting.
Great product placement.
Very good product placement. Were they playing Guitar Hero? Because I hear that's like the number one
game. They were playing tennis,
out there, right?
Yeah.
Oh, tennis. That's kind of lame.
Does that mean you watched, Mott?
I watched segments, yes.
Well, there was a section during the Academy Awards, which reminded me, actually, of one of my favorite parts of VH1, which I don't even have. I'm just throwing that out there. But I love watching those countdowns on VH1 where it's like, top 100 hard rock bands of all time. And, you know, you usually, like, catch it at about 62, and then you follow your way down, and inevitably it's like Motley Crue or someone. But anyway, last night they had
so
a roundup.
You're so strong in your
faith, Lisa. Well, you know, I'm continuing my theme of inappropriate topics for Christians. So last week, you know, threw that out there too. But no, there was a segment on the top, the movies that had won Best Picture of all time. And what, someone threw out the number because I don't know, 70?
Well, this is the 80th anniversary of the Oscars. So.
Okay, so they
so
showed
this year
the
was
79.
The 80th.
So 79.
Okay, yeah. So they showed 79. And we're just going to call Mott out and say that he announced that he had seen just an inordinate number of them. I thought it was totally inappropriate.
You know, I didn't know I was such a movie buff because I don't go to movies much anymore, but I had seen 42 of the 79.
Whoa. That's not right. And most of them were like from the 80s on, which aren't even the good ones.
And I tell you, that looks great on a resume.
Yeah.
That does.
Listen, my wife and I decided one time to get the old Oscar movies and thinking they would be good. Mm-hmm. We stopped after Marty, the worst movie ever made.
Just that actor kind of sketches me out. Okay, but really quickly around the table, of the 79, which one was your favorite of the best pictures of all time?
Casablanca.
Okay, I don't understand that movie.
Rocky. That's why I like it.
Rocky. I've never seen that, and that freaks me out.
A Man for All Seasons.
Wait.
Oh, that's like all whatever prophetic. That's a good one.
Lord of the Rings. I'm gonna say Lord of the Rings. Sorry,
Lord of the Rings. The book is better.
But it was Return of the King. It wasn't the first one.
It was.
Lord that of the was Rings the worst of the three.
It was to represent the whole trilogy.
Right.
Okay, the best movie ever, It Happened One Night, with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. It is
that was
fantastic.
A good film. That was a very good film.
It's so old, but it's so modern. The issues are every much applicable to today.
Yeah, and she gets to wear his pajamas, which is kind of hot. But I mean, whatever.
But
in an appropriate
scene.
You like that better
than
Chariots
of Fire.
Yeah, they got
the screen. It's just there's so much tension.
Oh, well, they're totally different. I love Chariots of Fire. That's my all-time favorite movie. So
Chariots of Fire is mine too, because it combines England running missions, just a bunch of different
and Dodie Fayed
and cool accents,
Dodie
Fayed, and new age music. So that's awesome.
You know, a lot of those old movies though, just
oh,
it's like walking into a house made in the 70s. It just doesn't make sense. The floor plan just doesn't make sense to my modern sensibilities.
That's true. But It Happened One Night. Have you seen that?
I did. I saw it in college, but I can't remember.
I mean, for any listener who hasn't seen it who loves Jane Austen and feels like Jane Austen is modern even though it's old-fashioned, same kind of feeling about that movie.
It's been said the flowers really need the sun, and the more the rain keeps falling, the rivers need somewhere to run.
Today we want to go ahead and jump into our roundtable session by talking about work, which in my book, is just inexplicable. and I know some people like to, you know, spiritualize it and make it a good thing, but there are just days when I don't want to get up.
Like God.
God.
Six
Whenever
days
God talks
work.
About it, I just get so irked, you know, because I'm just like, I don't want to work. But no, we were talking the other day about what, you know, really are you where you thought you would be at this point in life, like in your career? And if, you know, if you are, if you're not, what do you think about that and what kind of, you know, trajectory has that led you on, either in or out of it? I myself have either done really cool things with my career or really lame things. Like I had long stretches of temping peppered with like freelance gigs and like some publishing. And of course now, you know, since I've been at Focus, it's just been a big praise fest, you know, and I've just been moving on along. But
Coolest job ever.
Christian Disneyland. But anyway, I don't know. What do y'all think about that?
Well,
not about the Christian Disneyland, but about work.
Lisa, I see among the readers a balance when we get, anytime we blog about work or something, we just get the range of comments. And so we get people who talk about how they're blown away with what experiences they get, how blessed they are just to have a job in a tight economy or whatever. But then we do hear from readers who say, I'm pretty disappointed that I spent as much as I did on college or grad school and that I'm doing a job now that I don't even need a degree for, mm-hmm. and frustrated that I'm not experiencing what I had hoped to in this job, that the job's not the payoff, and wondering, do I need to just stay faithful to the job or should I be looking? Because they know their peers are looking.
Yeah. Well, just because you aren't using your degree now doesn't mean you won't need it in the future. I think trajectory is what Lisa opened with is a key word here. My first real job out of college, a chicken could have done it. And I joke about how you spread enough chicken feet on the F9 key because I was working on a DOS system.
Oh, man.
It was to generate constituent responses. But every once in a while, I got to do really cool stuff like write floor speeches for a senator and letters of meaning back to constituents. But there was a lot of it that was bad and boring.
But well, that's at least a path of, I mean, you were involved in just, I mean, say what you were doing.
I was a legislative correspondent for a U.S. Senator.
Well, and just that was cool. You could tell people. I mean,
no,
you know,
right.
the chicks didn't know you were doing the job of a chicken. You could say I work for a senator, and they were all over that.
And I mean, that at least has like there's a path to that. I mean, that's a career where you obviously like earn, you know, your stripes. And
yeah, that's true.
Well, I know. I think a lot of people forget that your first job, you almost should be paying your employer in terms of the gamble they're taking on you, mm-hmm. that the money really shouldn't be as big of an issue, although for people who bring a lot of debt out of college, it often is. But I think of my first job and just how little I made, that when I left, the president of the college where I've been managing the production centers, he said, well, Steve finally left because he realized that all the pizza he could eat wasn't a good salary after all.
Nice.
But it was one of these jobs where I was blown away by the level of responsibility placed on my shoulders at such an early age that stretched me that I didn't really notice that much that I was only getting $12,000 a year or whatever it was.
Right.
I mean,
well, and I think we have to delineate a little bit between, you know, there are people that go into school and they come out and they know that they're going to be like engineers or doctors or lawyers. Like that is a pretty cut and dry kind of thing. Then there are those of us who did the dreaded liberal arts degree. And when I graduated from school, my mom gave me a T-shirt and it was like, I have a liberal arts degree. Do you want fries with that? And she thought it was like super funny. And I'm like, I had to spend like 2 years even figuring out what I was going to do with my degree. So that was like a full-time job. In
my dad still doesn't even know what my degree technically was because it was like
a business
political science group major with an art minor.
Well,
what does that mean?
Like mine and I, who were English majors.
And English major.
I was an English major.
And oh my goodness, 4 out of 5. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And have you heard of Garrison Keillor's professional organization of English majors, which spells the acronym POEM?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
they're
how good
waiters.
They are at waiting tables.
Well, yeah, I started out with literature, and I wanted to teach literature, and then I saw all of my professors, and they were just freaky. I mean, like, one of them would read poetry in his office in the dark by himself, and I'm like, dude, I need to double. I need to get out of this, because I'm not going to end up like that. And so I doubled to communications with an emphasis
that's
in journalism,
what
and that's what
really?
I started
And you still that. Ended up like that.
And I still, so I mean, funny. I'm freaky, but at least I'm, like, deliberately freaky.
You
know,
I did
not,
that
you know,
with communications and with a specialty in advertising. That's what I wanted to get into.
And I did the communications special. Isn't it funny how you have to back up that English degree with something?
I backed it up with Spanish.
Oh, there you go.
In undergrad.
Nice.
Let me just say that all the jobs that I really liked, I got because I knew somebody. Like the job here.
That's a good method.
Yeah. You know, to be frank, I got this job because I knew Candace and Steve.
Yeah.
My previous job I got because I knew the boss. He and I were roommates at one time. Before that, something very similar. So, yeah, I've done my education. I've done, you know, I've studied hard and done well.
Yeah.
But the actual jobs came as a result of friendship.
Me too, every one of them.
The friendship's important, though, because we remembered you because we remember how good of a job you did. And so I think that kind of goes back to the faithful and little, that you never know when you feel like you're in a Mick job or something where you think, I am just too cool for this job, that being faithful there, somebody's watching. And that, I mean, I think of Paul Stanley, who was talking about visiting a guy who owns a McDonald's here in town. And they're sitting at the McDonald's, and he points out one of the guys, and he goes, you see this guy here? He said he's only been on the job for a couple of months, but he's already the manager, because he didn't look down on the job mm-hmm. and say, I'm too cool for this, and I'm just waiting, holding out until you know, my record deal comes through,
that's right.
and I get to be a rock star.
Well, because you can't control the friendship connections. You don't know when the open door is going to come, when someone's going to call you and say, oh, I was just thinking about you and I've got this opening. You know, you all dream about that kind of a job. What you can control is how you treat the job you actually have, your current situation. And if you're faithful, then you can trust that God's going to open the doors he wants you to walk through.
And some employers judge you about on how well you do the small stuff, because it's, everybody can do the fun stuff. Everybody wants to do the important stuff, but how well are you going to do the mundane?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect example of Joseph. I mean, you think about the jobs Joseph had on the way to becoming number two in Egypt. And he had so many opportunities to say, I'm just going through the motions. I'm just going to punch my card, and I'm going to sit there and play free cell and go visit Drudge Report or whatever during the day. Obviously, he didn't quite have Drudge yet. But the
a couple years later.
But instead, obviously, he decided, I'm going to be faithful. And God blessed him with every responsibility he had.
Well, now, how can you make the most of a difficult job, a boring job?
Well, I wrote a blog a while back, and it was taken from lifehacker.com, and he has six tips for doing boring stuff well, and he wrote it for people just like that, Ted, who are in those mundane jobs who want to get out, and here are the tips that he writes. Number one, look at the long-term benefit. Number two, find what you can learn from it. Number three, think of doing it for someone you love. Four, enjoy the interaction with the people. Five, think and say something positive. And six, gather with passionate people. I thought it was pretty good advice.
It is. Yeah. It reminds me, the love line reminds me of when the Jimmy Braddock and Cinderella Man was fighting. And he had no shot to beat Max Baer. And yet every punch in his mind, he's thinking of his kids who are hungry and who need milk. And he's fighting for the milk money. And I know this isn't a relationship show, but I can't help going there. It's my issue. How do you work for someone you love when you're not married? Who do you work for? Your mom? I mean, for the single person...
You work for God.
But isn't there a practice? I just find it interesting.
Well,
there is
additional incentive. That's why all the studies show that married men with kids make more money, because there's extra incentive. You're not just doing it for personal reasons.
They spend more money as well.
Well, the only thing in that list that I take issue with is that I think that each of those examples shows you how to like put up with what you're doing currently. I think there has to be some forward thinking, like vision for, well, you know, if you are saying, you know, hey, I want to start a family, I want to get married, I want to have kids, mm-hmm. you can't be in a Mick job for 20 years.
Well,
you have to find
have
a way to move on.
All the mentors we've talked to have said your 40s, kind of get moving into 50, is really prime time, where you're combining your energy with wisdom and experience, and to recognize that you're not going to make your primary contribution in your 20s and 30s. You shouldn't be that anxious about not having the ideal job yet, but you should be thinking towards 40. You should be wondering, I mean, looking to see how your steps are progressing towards your prime contribution.
At the same time, young adults have been doing amazing things in their young years. You look at George Washington, you look at...
Teddy Roosevelt.
When they're
Bill
teens
Gates.
In their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This raises
from all the dot coms.
Since the public schools,
they got on their horse,
so
and it was crazy.
But do young adults expect a lot coming out of college now? Do they expect to have the dream job? And
they've been told their whole life they can be anything they want to be, and that they're going to go places, and the millennials are special.
And the news is, you can't be anything you want to be.
You got to ask, what does God want me to be? But the better question is not, what can I be of any choice, but what is God calling? What does God require?
And how can you do? How can you do any job as unto the Lord, knowing that it is a lot of times going to be the things you do in private, and not necessarily the big wins that matter the most. That matter at an eternal level. But usually, that's what matters to the boss as well.
Yeah, there's a danger in thinking that God is only in the spectacular. God is in the mundane things too.
And you know, we have so inflated the role of job in our identity and in what gives our lives meaning. In another day, people worked literally to put food on the table.
Well, and too, they considered it a good thing. I mean, going back to the scripture from the Bible, the whole Sabbath command, we forget the first part of that is 6 days you shall work. And the idea was that work is something you should do, and we forget the curse of the garden wasn't to have to work. It was just that work was going to be more complicated because of the thorns and thistles. But the work itself is something that God takes pleasure in seeing us do.
I think getting back to, you know, it seems like most of the people, there's a difference between languishing. Like I almost see a Great Commission parallel, kind of like the, you know, go and make disciples is as you are going, you know, and making disciples is really the main thing. It's kind of like as you are working, you know, whatever, like you were saying, Candace, there's nothing wrong with working, and we all have to. And certainly you can set your sights on other things while you're doing it. And I think what Ted said was great, that, you know, there is no shame in like knowing people and in utilizing connections. I mean, that is, it's huge. And to cultivate those kind of connections and to, you know, move into stuff that you're interested in. But I do think we fall into the trap of it has to be super exciting and it has to be this and that. And if you don't get something right out of the gate, you know, if you're not, then you're just going to become a consultant because everyone thinks they just need to be a consultant and travel everywhere and just, you know, pull in huge paychecks for doing a big zero, nothing.
Well, I think a good point tied to Ted's idea about relationships is don't burn bridges. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people who is that they burn the bridge that could have been a great connection down the road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and if, you know, people say 2 years is what you really need to give a job, even if you hate it, because you don't want to have a bunch of 6-month commitments on your resume, because that's such a red flag to an employer. If you're in a job you really despise and you're, you know, 6 months or a year and a half even away from being able to move on to something else, take all your energy and passion and get an avocation. Have something you do on the side where you really can feel like you're in a challenging task that you love. You know, start skydiving.
And that can be part of a resume too, that there are a lot of employers who know that a young employee is not going to have a massive resume, but they'll often look for their volunteering, their associations, and other places where they've taken on responsibility and been a good steward to round out their opinion of their potential as an employee.
It's true. All right. Well, these are good thoughts. We would obviously love to hear from you, our listeners, as to what's your current job? Are you where you thought you would be? Are you trying to move along some kind of continuum? And where are you on that? Where did you, how'd you even get where you are? And just any tips and techniques and things you've learned along the way would be awesome.
Or principles.
Scriptural principles are good, too. We're into those. Anyway, we would love to hear from you. Just email us at editor@boundless.org, and we will take your thoughts, and, you know, maybe you'll show up in a future podcast. We'll talk about you. So email us.
A donde nadie ha llegado, al sol de un cielo más claro, donde las nubes son espuma y llueven como ninguna.
All right, for this week's culture segment, we have a couple members of the band Salvador, otherwise known as Salvador.
That's good. That's
sorry, good. The Bay Area of California. That's the exception. Oh, I did live in Paraguay for a little bit, though.
Oh, very cool.
But anyway, Paraguay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have both Nick and Chris with us here.
Bienvenidos, Boundless
Great
Podcast.
Great to see you
show.
And
Thank
to finally
much.
Meet you. They actually just joined us in our chapel, in our Focus on the Family chapel today, which was fantastic all around. I've decided to start telling my friends that they need to just take time off from work and visit our chapels.
I concur.
I'm going to put the shout out for that because that's important, I think, especially for our demographic. So I'm going to start doing that. Anyway, we just had a great time with them. And I want to kind of kick this interview off with one. Sarah, my team member, is out here in the studio. Shout out to her. And she and I were talking. She's a fan as well. And we were wondering how, coming from a background that I know you, Nick, are the son of a pastor,
yes.
pastors.
Mm-hmm.
Any other band members' backgrounds as far as...
I'm Chris. My dad, for a long time, was a music pastor. He's semi-retired right now. But yeah, I grew up as a music pastor's son as well.
Okay.
This so is Ted. I'm an honorary member of the band, and my father's not a pastor. I'm backup.
Okay. That is so
We forgot to tell Ted where awesome. His pink slip is in the mail.
Yeah, sorry. It's been nice, though.
Better
it's
known now.
Real and fun.
It's a short career.
Real fun.
Yeah. Well, he can still haul boxes for you.
There we go. There we go.
Do something like that. Right. Well, I want to know, how did you grow up in the ministry in that sense and escape unscathed?
You know, I think I think that we use that term loosely, unscathed. You know, I have to be honest with you. My mom and dad became pastors when I was 18 years old. 17 and 18 is, I think, the years that they just kind of started their own church. But I've been a deacon's kid for a long time. But, you know, honestly, when I was 4 years old, my dad was the janitor at our church and my mom was the secretary. And I think when I turned about 12 or 13, my dad finally became an usher. And still was the janitor, and then when we moved over to our another church when I was about 14, they became kind of like assistant pastors to my aunt and uncle, and it's kind of been one of those things where I believe that there's a million ways to grow up in church, but the way that I grew up, I honestly saw my mom and dad serving our church for days upon days and hours upon hours. And I always tell people that I am the product of what happens when your family's faithful. I think that I've reaped the benefit of my mom and dad being faithful to church. And so they became pastors, yes, but I grew up under the pew, as they say, because my mom was there early to do secretary work. My dad was always there to make sure last-minute preparations were made for service, but they were not there to be honored. They were there to serve, and it's been an amazing thing. I can talk about my mom and dad and honestly say that they did not do it so that way people could say, wow, good job. They did it because they knew that they were serving God with what they were doing.
Hmm. That's fantastic. Chris?
My story, and I'll say this first part with all, honestly, with all sincerity, I am an experiment, hopefully not gone horribly wrong, of parents using, my parents using and really taking to heart two books, The Strong-Willed Child and Love Must Be Tough. And I mean, I remember seeing those books.
Who are those
I remember,
by?
Yeah, somebody. I think
absolutely.
He might have some ties to this organization. I don't know.
Just Google those titles, and you'll find out.
Maybe affiliated.
But Dr. Dobson's ministry directly impacted probably my backside for a while as a small child, but directly impacted my life and my parents' life, and they were really committed to raise me up in a godly home, put me in a. You know, we went to church when I was really young. With my own decision and of clear mind when I was six, accepted Christ. And then, but I had them there to really show me what that meant as I grew up. My dad didn't become a full-time music pastor until I was going into high school. And we moved, I went to a wonderful Christian school up in Illinois. And then we moved to Missouri. He became a music pastor and I went into public school for the first time. So actually being so involved in church directly like that as a sort of a family member type of a church was a great experience to help buffer me from all these new things that I was around. You know, suddenly there's drugs in the hall and just all kinds of things I'd never been exposed to. And then all of a sudden just be thrown in. My youth group was right there with me. It was a really good experience. So I lived a very blessed childhood that keeping my eyes focused on Jesus was not a solo act. I had a lot of help, and I'm really grateful for that.
It's the same old story, time and time again. I listen for a while, then I do my own thing. Lessons come and go, like water through my hands. Such a sweet intention, but it always ends.
And now, here's Steve Waters with The Hungry Years.
After the United States withdrew from the Vietnam War over 30 years ago, communist forces in the North began their descent on Saigon. By April of 1975, South Vietnamese were scrambling to get out any way they could. A guy named Major Bung Lee crammed himself, his wife, and five children into a single-seat Cessna 01 Bird Dog to escape. As he flew through dense fog, he came under Viet Cong fire and found himself heading out to sea. When he was miles from shore and running low on fuel, he spotted the USS Midway in the South China Sea. He flew towards it with hopes of landing on the carrier's large deck, but as he got closer, he saw that the flight deck was filled with helicopters that had been used to evacuate Saigon. The crew of the USS Midway looked up in the air and saw his plane flying overhead, and then saw a survival pistol land on their deck with a note attached. The note read, "Can you move these helicopters to the other side? I can land on your runway. I can fly 1 hour more. We have enough time to move them. Please rescue me. Major Bung Lee, wife and five children." The ship's admiral got the message, and his heart went out to the family. The problem was, these weren't just any old helicopters. They were UH-1 Hueys, large transport helicopters that were also very expensive. But he didn't want to miss the opportunity to help, and so he gave an order to his men, clear the decks. And they did. They pushed $10 million worth of helicopters overboard into the sea, and the plane was able to land safely. This is a story that reminds me of Dr. Hubert Morkin, who's one of my favorite professors in graduate school. Clear the decks was a phrase he often used to encourage his students to be prepared for action and opportunity. I once asked him where he got the phrase. "It's an ancient naval term," he said. When the captain told sailors to clear the decks, they would stow their hammocks, put away any tables, chairs, other loose items, and make sure there was nothing cluttering the deck. Dr. Morkin made the connection to our need to clear the decks of our personal lives and be ready for action. That means not letting clutter, debt, or anything else pile up in our lives. But Dr. Morkin also saw another context for clearing decks. He said there's the idea of keeping your decks clear for action, maintaining an uncluttered life in preparation for opportunity, but then there's what you do when opportunities actually appear. Going back to naval history, he explained that before the 20th century, sailors would keep their decks basically clear, but when action came and the captain yelled, "Clear the decks," the sailors really got to work. Often they'd take tables and chairs and anything else that was in the way and just throw them right overboard. These were things that had been useful in the past, just a few minutes before, but were now holding them back. That's the tough part, Morkin explained. The Bible talks about pruning away branches so that the tree will be more fruitful. Cutting hurts, but it brings growth. When God sends opportunities our way, sometimes it requires us to leave the security of things behind in order to act on what's ahead. The UH-1 Hueys were the perfect tool for getting people out of Saigon, but by the time the Bung Lee family was looking for a place to land, they had become obstacles. In the same way that the crew of the Midway dumped those expensive helicopters, the right opportunity can lead God to call us to leave behind possessions, commitments, things that were once perfectly in line with His will, but aren't anymore. As you think about your own life, what opportunities do you have to get rid of clutter? Are there any big, even important things that may have become obstacles to action and opportunity? Whatever it is that might be holding you back, be willing to trust God's commands as the captain of your ship. You never know what adventures are ahead when He calls out to you. Clear the decks!
That's your free to be exactly who you are today. And I know in life it's sometimes hard to find your way. But you need to know that as you are okay. And it's good to see you. Cause you're beautiful to me.
Opening up this week's Boundless Inbox, we have a question from Rachel, and I'm going to throw this out to Steve and Candace, who are here with me in the studio today. Dear Boundless, I'm in the most difficult position of my life right now and would very much appreciate some advice. I'm in love with the most amazing man, and we're discussing marriage. We're positive it's God's will for us to marry. The big problem is that my parents disapprove of us getting married. I'm completely at a loss of what to do. My boyfriend and I both agree moving forward without the approval and blessing of my parents is really unwise. And I don't want to dishonor my parents, but I really need them to let me make my own decision on this. What should I do?
Well, Rachel, my first question would be, if we were sitting down over coffee, I'd say, how do you know it's God's will for you to marry this young man? And so start with thinking through the reasons you think it's definitely God's will, and make sure that those reasons are lining up with what Scripture says. And then I would say, well, what do your mentors and other people in your life who aren't your parents think about this? Are your pastors on board? Do your mentors approve? Do you have a lot of older Christians who you respect saying to you, yes, you guys are a good match and you're a good fit? And then if you're left with only your parents disapproving, I would suggest you sit down with your boyfriend, with your parents, and just say, Mom and Dad, what are your objections to us getting married? And then, if there are legitimate objections, to work with them to develop the steps that they want you and your boyfriend to go through to demonstrate that you really are prepared to take on this commitment. So there's nothing wrong with engaging them and asking why they're opposed to the marriage and trying to really address those concerns. If, however, they share concerns that really are not legitimate, and maybe you could even run that past your pastor or a mentor, and they agree and say, you know, those aren't really good reasons to not marry this guy, then I think you respectfully address with your parents, or, you know, show them how you've already overcome those hurdles and demonstrate that those aren't really legitimate concerns. Then you can move ahead with love and respect to your parents, knowing that you've been faithful, you've done your part, and you've honored them in the process, but you ultimately do have the ability and the authority as an adult coming under the headship of your future husband to say, we love you, we respect you, we're willing to work with you on this, but we're going to move forward.
Yeah, I appreciate Rachel's desire to maintain relationship with their parents. And I think so often in our culture, we're so individualistic. We just think we can just tough it out ourselves. And then, you know, you fall in love with somebody and you say, it's just us against the world and we can make it on our own. And that might fly for a year or two. But especially when you start having kids, family gets woven back into your life in such a big way. And they really need to be a part of your life. So I think it's important for them to look forward 5 to 10 years and to say, what would life look like if we plowed through in a way that's not respectful and loving of the family versus what it would look like if we really pause and take the time to try to woo them to appreciate and support our relationship.
Right. And if they ask you to wait a year or 6 months, to know that if it is God's will, if He is in favor of this marriage, that adding 6 months or a year won't change the fact that you're going to end up married and you'll have the rest of your lives together.
Well, and two, they will spend a lot of their life, not only with through kids, they will spend a lot of their life working through issues related to in-laws and to family of origin type issues. And so this is the first test of that process that they're going to be spending the rest of their life going through. And they don't want to fail the test now.
Right, because how they handle this will sort of set the pattern for the rest of their marriage.
Really well.
Okay, so couples moving into a relationship, for example. I mean, let's just assume that some people are naive. What are some of the things that they can anticipate coming up against as objections from parents? I mean, outside of the fact, you know, you need to make sure that you're dating and ultimately moving towards marriage with someone who is a believer.
Right.
What are some other legitimate things that they need to be looking at?
I think it typically comes down to parents are looking at how they treat each other. Are they just so blissfully in love that they're overlooking bad patterns in whether or not they're loving and respecting each other? And two, I think they are typically looking at a son-in-law and they're asking, is this guy going to step up? Is he going to be trustworthy and not leave this relationship prematurely? Is he going to take care of the family, any kids that come along? Because I think that's what a lot of in-laws are concerned about, whether or not they can trust their daughter to someone else's care.
Right. And I think on a practical side, money and sex. So how does this guy handle his finances? And I think any dad who says, son, I want to see your checkbook, maybe not literally, but is a young man should be willing to talk through his finances with a future father-in-law to be able to demonstrate that he's going to be able to provide for this family he's taking responsibility for. And then if the couple is being sexually promiscuous, the parents are right to assume that they have lost their ability to think clearly about the relationship.
Good. Okay. Well, that ties back into, obviously, our roundtable as far as work. It shows you that there are good questions to start asking, and that forward thinking and forward visionary planning is always good. That, and, you know, just start writing a list. And if you know you're going to come up against godly, you know, parents who are going to ask you the hard questions, be prepared for them. Don't get 6 months or more into a relationship with a loser or, you know, and being, like you said, you know, you know, someone who doesn't have a job or, you know, you are sexually promiscuous. Hello, people. Let's start, you know, looking at this sensibly and figuring out what's biblical and going from there. So thank you, Steve and Candace, for your input. Again, we always want to hear from our listeners. So we want you to write us at editor@boundless.org. with your questions and your comments. We want to address them here. They don't have to be about relationships. They can be about anything. You know, we run the gamut there. So please do write us. Until next week, this is your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.